whether it's typical or atypical. Oh, come on over here. Don't sit over there. Come on, here's a, up there. You can sit with Norma. Yeah, let's all put her right here together. So anyway, next week what I started to say was, I'm going to do this the next 2 weeks. So deacons, song leaders, heads up. I'm going to do just a class format the next two Sunday nights, because I want to make this interactive as we think about discipleship. In fact, if I can figure out a way to make this work, we might even divide up into some groups next two Sunday nights. And I think I can. It's just a matter of getting some people to kind of help me be group leaders and figure out how we could divide it men and women, or we could divide it. I don't know. We'll figure out some way. I'm not going to do a regular preaching lesson the next two Sunday nights. Because we really want to emphasize on discipleship. And discipleship is about studying, and it's about learning, and it's about involvement. And so I think that will lend itself a little bit more toward what we want to accomplish. So anyway, before we get started, how about them Royals? Yeah. Huh? In the bottom of the 10th, I was watching the game. In the 9th, they got two men on and two outs and get a single. Tie the game up. In the bottom of the 9th, they win the game. So I'm getting all about it, Jerry. In fact, I will ask you a trivia question. How many know? I bet everybody knows the answer to this. Who was the first Royal in history to hit for the cycle? If you know, raise your hand. You know. You two know. You guys know? All right, anybody else know? Now you're guessing. Some of you are kind of guessing who you think it was. Huh? Frank White, George Brett, or Freddie Pontek? It was Freddie. We were at the game last night. It was so funny. We had just come down from eating and got our seats, and this guy sitting behind us, Fred called him Doc. I guess he was a trainer, right, when he played. And he said, "You're the trivia question tonight." You know how they put that on the scoreboard? And that was the question. And Doc says, "Freddie, I think it's you." Fred said, "Yeah, it is." Now, who would have guessed that? The mighty, mighty big powerhouse hitting for the cycle. Yeah. So, anyway, I'm getting into it. Norma said, "Are you?" In fact, I turned the radio on the way to try to catch into this game. She said, "Are you getting back into baseball?" I said, "Oh yeah. I'm getting all about it." Okay. Well, let's get into the Word. Okay. Matthew chapter 5. Did everybody get a handout sheet? If you came in to get a handout sheet, there's some on the table in the back. Anybody didn't get a handout sheet, raise your hand and Mark could get you one, or Phil. Everybody got one? Okay, here's a young man. Can you write? You old enough to write? Okay, that's good. Just kidding. All right. If you didn't get one, raise your hand. These guys will get you one. Okay. It's not a fill in the blank, but I just want you to take some notes and write down some things that we're talking about as we go through Matthew 5, okay? All right, let's pause for just a moment and pray together. Righteous Father, we're grateful for the beauty of the day, for the opportunity you provide for worship, for Bible study, for our fellowship here, and all the blessings you give us. May we be directed through your word, that we may be discipled to follow after Jesus and to become more conformed to his image and less of the things of the world. Bless us in our study tonight. Through Christ we ask, amen. Now, what I want to do, Matthew 5, I mean, we could take weeks on Matthew 5. So I just want to hit some high points with it. You know, the Sermon on the Mount is being called the Magna Carta of the Kingdom. It's one of the great titles given to it. I think Foy Wallace in his book called it Pentecost Pointers. Another commentator called it the Manifesto of the King. And I decided to go, okay, I know we're reading Luke, but Luke doesn't cover the Sermon on the Mount to the extent Matthew does. I just like the division of these three chapters in Matthew. So this kind of supplements your Luke reading, gives you a little fuller reading here of the Sermon on the Mount. So as you can see by the little outline you have, we're just going to hit some high points that I hope will help us just a little bit. The first 12 verses begin here with having the right spirit. The right spirit begins with the right attitude. It says, and seeing the multitudes, he went up on a mountain, and when he was seated, his disciples came to him, and he opened his mouth and taught them, saying, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those that mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the sons of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when they shall revile and persecute you and say all kinds of evil against you falsely for my sake. Rejoice and be exceedingly glad, for great is your reward in heaven. For so they persecuted the prophets that were before you. When you think of the word blessed, what do you think of? You have this repeat word repeated, blessed, blessed, blessed. What comes to your mind thinking of the word blessed? Anybody? Blessed. Sometimes, what word do we sometimes hear in the place of blessed? Lucky? Well, I haven't heard that, but maybe you have. In fact, some books and some translations, some modern speech translations, translate this instead of blessed as what? Happy. The word can denote happiness. I do think, however, that shortchanges the meaning of this word in the Greek language to say happy. Because what do we think of when we think of happiness? In our culture today, and we think of being happy, what comes to your mind? What kind of things? A lot of times more selfish things, like what? What makes you happy? Not necessarily you personally, but what do most people in the world think makes them happy? Okay, as the old boy said, get more specific. Money, thank you. If I had more money, I'd be happier, right? People think that. What else? Okay, if I had a better job, if I had a better paying job, if I had a job that wasn't so boring, if I had a job with more responsibility, with more prestige, I'd be happy. What else? All right, now you're rolling. What else? What else do most people think makes them happy?
Good health.
What's that, Brandon? Health? Yeah, if I didn't have all these aches and pains, I'd be happy. You know, if I was in better health, if I didn't have these ailments, if I had this disease, if I didn't have this disability, if I didn't have a case of the uglies, I mean, all these kind of things. When at our culture, if I was prettier or more handsome, if I had less weight or more weight, see, all these kind of things we think will make us happy. What else? What else is most people, Bruce?
Power.
Yes. A position, power, that we can wield it over people. Yeah. You know, you ever wonder why people that are multi-millionaires that are up in years still want to be in the Senate or the Congress or be an ambassador? I guess I'm a little cynical. You could say because they love public service. You're laughing too. I just kind of think there is a power, and it's not that these people need any more money, most of them. And you look at John Kerry. I mean, he is wealthy, 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 wealthy. I mean, he retired to an island. He could buy an island. In fact, he may own an island. I don't know. But people like position and power. And that's just, my dad used to talk about, my dad worked for Uniroyal 33 years in the factory. He used to laugh and talk about people that would take a supervisory position and take a pay cut because they like being a supervisor of that plant, of that unit in the factory. And they actually made less money than working production. But they like being a supervisor because you have some position and prestige and power. And now I'm not charging. I've said that someone here just took that job. So I'm not accusing everybody. But I think most of you'd agree there are people that are motivated by that. Okay. Now, what are all of those kinds of things? All those things, everything that we just mentioned, from money to health to power to... They're material, they're worldly, they're what else? Huh?
Superficial.
All right, thank you. What else? Short-lived, they are that, yes. Is someone back here? They're temporary, okay. They're all of those things, and all of those things you said are external. They are external things that create happiness. Blessedness is deeper than that. Now, when you just peruse these eight things we read, what do these things that are blessed speak of? Poor in spirit, those that mourn, meek, hunger and thirst after righteousness, mercy, peacemakers, pure in heart. What do those things speak of? Internal. That was the word I'll get to you. That's exactly the word. And I set you up because well, those other things are external and they appeal more to happiness. This appeals more to the internal. So that the idea of blessedness, I think, is deeper, especially with the way we use the word happy in our culture today. See, what'd you start to say, Janice?
I was
going to
say a matter of your heart or the tenderness.
That's internal. Yeah, it's a matter of your heart, your spirit, your soul. And so you divide these up. In fact, the William Barclay and his Family Bible Study series said the greatness of the Beatitudes is that they are not wistful glimpses of some future beauty. They are not even golden promises of some distant glory. They are triumphant shouts of bliss for a permanent joy that nothing in this world can take away. That's what they are. And thus there is joy and happiness. And the Beatitudes speak to those of us that have a blessedness, a spiritual fortitude and fortunateness. I don't know, I may just have made up a word there. That allows, I think I did make up a word, huh, Jerry? You liked it, don't you? But we are fortunate spiritually, not by chance or luck, but because God has blessed us. So, the Beatitudes I have in your notes, they're divided up in two ways. They relate, number one, in your attitude toward God. Having the right spirit begins with the right attitude, i.e. Beatitudes, you see. The Beatitudes are attitudes we have toward God. Poor in spirit, that speaks to what? What would be one word that speaks to poor in spirit? Sad. Well, that would be one word. It's not the word I was thinking of, but that would be. I asked a question, what would be one word? So that'd be one word. Humble. That's the word I was thinking of. Yeah. They speak to the idea of humility. If you're poor in spirit, I think this is the notion of being poor in spirit. You know, I heard a guy one time say that it's wrong to be rich materially. The Bible says you ought to be poor. Did it say that there's a blessedness in living at a poverty level? That's not what it said. Not talking about poor in terms of your bank account. A man can be wealthy and be poor in spirit. And a person could be living below the poverty level and not be poor in spirit. Because that's not external. See? What gets in the way of being humble? One thing. Yes. What'd you see, Jerry? Pride. That is the great nemesis of this, of our pride. Jesus was humble, and you see the humility of Jesus. And as you read the book of Luke and John, look for this, all right? Blessed are those that mourn. I call this the bliss of the broken heart. To mourn means to grieve or to lament. Now, what do you think Jesus might have in mind that we might mourn over? What might we mourn over? We might mourn over death. But in our relationship to God, if these four Beatitudes really kind of speak a relationship we have to God, and I look at my standing before God, and I mourn. What, Norma Jean? Sin. I think, I might be wrong, but I think that inherent in this notion here is the person that grieves over his weaknesses and over his faults and shortcomings and over his sin. Now, certainly there might be other things, but in my relationship to God, I see my unworthiness. And so, therefore, I don't come before God with some kind of haughtiness. Blessed are the meek. Now, my little footnote here on this is, it says meek and not weak. See, we confuse meekness with weakness. Was Jesus meek? You think Jesus was meek? You don't? Well, I didn't expect to get that answer. Well, I think he was. I think Jesus was a meek person in spirit with the way he conducted himself in dealing with people and with situations. But meekness is not a weakness. And I set myself up for that, I know. So because you see the strength of you. The word meekness really, in fact, Aristotle defined this Greek word or illustrated this Greek word with being able to control a horse, of putting a bit in a horse's mouth. So you look at a horse that has great power, and yet those of you that ride horses know that you put a bit in a horse's mouth, and this great, magnificent, strong animal, that you control that strength. So meekness is strength under control. See, Jesus had the power to wipe people off the face of the earth. He had the power to come down from the cross. But you see a strength under control in the way that Jesus lived his life. And that's really what meekness is. It's not a wishy-washy attitude. See, we think of someone that's meek as they kind of won't look you in the eye and they all shucks. They got this all shucks kind of a, and they're humble and meek and, well, that's not what he's talking about at all. Jesus wasn't that kind of person. That you see the power and the strength of Jesus, but the meekness comes that he controlled it. And he didn't use his prerogatives in a selfish way. And thus the idea of meekness. And then hungering and thirst after righteousness. Not blessed are those that hunger and thirst after happiness. But those that hunger and thirst after right, this could be moral righteousness that pleases God. Certainly we know that righteousness is revealed in the gospel. And there ought to be a hungering, a desire for things that are right. Now, in that analogy, when you think of the analogy of hungering and thirsting after righteousness, what did Jesus say in a couple of the I am statements that speak to this? If you use this metaphor, I am the That would be one. I am the living water. And if you come to me, you'll never thirst. And then, okay, now you got it. The other one is, I am what? Thought I heard it. Thank you. The bread of life. So how do you hunger and thirst? How do you satiate your hunger and your thirst and satisfy that? Come to Christ. And you will satisfy your hunger and thirst for righteousness by coming to Christ. Now, the last four of these Beatitudes speak of our relationship to people. Mercy. Now, how many of you want to have God's mercy? Let me see your hands that want God to be merciful to you. Okay, mostly two or three of you don't, but most of you, yes, you have your hands up. I know it's been a long day. Raise my hand. I know it's a silly question. Everybody. Well, I hope everybody wants God's mercy. Well, if you want God's mercy, what do you have to be? Merciful. You have to be merciful. in your relationship to your fellow man. And so blessed are they merciful that extend mercy toward other people, for you shall receive mercy. Now, what do you think the antithesis of that is? That if you're not merciful toward other people, then what? What, Rachel? Yeah, in fact, Jesus said as much when he talked about forgiveness, that we'll get to that next week in Matthew 6. That if you don't forgive your men their trespasses, neither will your heavenly Father forgive you your trespasses. Well, that has to do with the idea of being merciful. All right, the pure in heart, the unsoiled heart, the sincere heart. The word pure means free from admixture. Free from admixture. Free from corrupt desire. Free from impurity. And to see God, we're not talking about literally seeing God, but that would connote what?
A right relationship,
yeah. I'm talking about a relationship or fellowship with God. So blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Peacemakers, by the way, not peace lovers, not people that march and everything and then they, you know, get in a riot and get thrown in jail or something like that. So well, they were, it was a peace protest. No. Peacemakers, an attitude that seeks and desires a harmonious relationship in relationships. And then blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness and endure suffering for Christ. People that belong to Christ. And see, we're talking here about being discipled, aren't we? This whole focus on discipleship. So if we're properly discipled and we're persecuted, what do we do? According to this. What does it say we do right here in this text? You just look at the word. It's an R word.
Rejoice.
Now, there's another hard word that you don't do.
Retaliate.
Now, have you ever heard someone say, I don't get mad, I get even? I've heard that. Now, that's really being discipled. That's following Christ, isn't it? That's what Christ did. He was out to get even, right? Not. And so, when we're persecuted, rejoice that you're privileged to be to suffer for Christ. All right, we can spend about 8 weeks on that, but we need to move on if we're going to hit these other things. All right, verses 13 through 16. I would have folks read, but we got so many, probably easy for me to read. You can probably hear me better. You are the salt of the earth, but the salt loses its flavor. How shall it be seasoned? It is then good for nothing but to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. You are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do they light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand it gives light to all that are in the house. Therefore, let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven. Now, this speaks to the idea of the right influence. Now, what are the two metaphors here for influence? All right, yeah, salt and light. Now, what does the word salt suggest? Talk to me a minute. When you think of salt, you're the salt of the earth, and you use this as a metaphor, then what might be some ideas of salt? What does salt do?
Change.
What, Bill?
Change flavor.
It flavors things? Okay, good. What else? What did you say? Yeah, I know your name, Diane. No, I was looking at you, Diane. I'm just... Okay, preserves, thank you. Yeah, so salt flavors, salt preserves. What else do you think of salt?
Heals.
It does, yeah, okay. It heals, that's a good thought. Salt also metaphorically has a picture of what? When you think of just salt. I thought maybe I heard it. If you got it, just holler it out. Did someone say purity? It didn't. Well, someone say purity.
Purity.
Okay, you're right. That's right. And I'm not making this up. I mean, if you look back in ancient literature, the Romans actually believed that salt was the purest of all elements. You know why? Because it came from the sun and the sea. And so they therefore believed that this is the pure. And you think of salt is white. And because of the things you said, the healing properties, the preserving properties, and it has flavor. And so the idea of purity. Now, what does salt do if you go to the movie theater, do they put salt on the popcorn? Why? Makes you thirsty. Then you want to buy one of those $5 drinks that are unbelievable. You know, $5 drinks. Salt makes people thirsty. So you're the salt of the earth. So, you know, I'm not 100% sure what Jesus had in mind here. Maybe it's all of those things. Maybe for us to think about. But it could be all those things, couldn't it? That we're a preserving influence and we should add flavor to life. That we're not a wet blanket and a killjoy. Christianity is not that. That we can provide healing, that there's purity. And do we make people thirsty for the gospel? We should, shouldn't we? Okay. Now, he says something really unique here. Salt is of no value unless what? What, Dick? Unless it's used. It's like if you come to our house. By the way, does everybody know they're invited to our house tonight? You didn't know that. Well, I sent out an email. So how many of you read my blog? No, I'm not going to go there again. Okay. But I sent out an email. Okay. So if you didn't know that, you're still invited. But you'll have to bring food. Now, there is one caveat. You can come and not bring food. And that is if you get in the back of the line. So if there's no food left, then that would teach you for not bringing food. I don't know. I'm just kind of joking around about that because usually plenty of food. But if you can come, we'd love for you to bring something. And, you know, it's a nice spring day here in Kansas City. And we can sit out on the deck and the porch and whatever and just enjoy ourselves. You're laughing. It is. The sun is out. It's over 60 degrees. In fact, it's going to get warmer as the night goes along. 73 in Texas. Okay, don't even talk to me about that. Where was I going? I was going somewhere. Oh, salt. So if you come over to our house and you get a dish and one of the ladies didn't put any salt in and you say, this doesn't have any salt. And she said, yeah, a lot of people can't eat salt. I didn't put any salt on this. And you say, Norma Jean, do you have any salt? She goes, yeah. And she puts a salt shaker out there and you look at it. And you just keep eating the unsalted food. Now, what would that be called? Silly. Stupid. Okay. Or silly. Okay. That's probably a nicer word. You said stupid, right? Okay. Silly. Okay. I shouldn't say that because one time I sat down and my mother came up and she said, her son said, the preacher said a bad word. Because you've been trying to get the kids not to say this. Don't say that, the S word. Okay. Stupid. Okay. How about silly? Is that okay? That is silly. But is it any sillier, or the other word, to pile all this salt up in the church building? And we got all this salt here. And we got shepherds of salt. And we got deacons of salt. And we got evangelists of salt. And we come and we look at the salt and we say, we sure got a lot of salt. Isn't this great? We're the salt of the earth. And we got it all piled up in this church building. Now, what value is that?
None if you don't use it.
Not much if we're not out there. See, we're supposed to get out into the world with our salt shakers. Yeah, see? And we're supposed to be salt as we come in relationship with people, all right? The second word here is light. What does light do? Jerry? Huh?
It's bright. That you see.
Okay, all right. So it illuminates. All right, that's what you said. You can see it. It's bright, you can see it. So light illuminates or dispels darkness. What else does light do? What it might do. What? Thought I heard a word back here. Is that you, Rachel?
Yeah.
What'd you say?
It guides.
Guides, okay. You guides. Yeah. It's like when I'm out of town, I carry a little flashlight with me, because you stay places sometimes and it's real dark. I might get hungry in the middle of the night and want to get up at my age. Okay? Yeah. All the guys know what I'm talking about. I don't want to stumble on the way to the room. So I have a little light that guides me so I can see where I'm going. All right? What else does light do? Who said that? Kim? Thank you. That's exactly what I was looking for. Warns. Light warns. So you have warning lights. See? Flashy warning lights. So you're the light of the world. Do we guide? Do we illuminate? Do we warn? Well, we should. We certainly can. And God wants us to. But both of these metaphors speak to the issue of influence. They're all about influence. So if you kind of sum this up, and let's just bullet this real quick for a couple minutes, then we'll finish this up. What influence lessons do we learn here? If you just take the concept, you're the salt of the earth and light of the world, and what he said, what are some influence lessons that you see out of these three verses? Four verses. All right. Pete, you got any influence lessons that come to your mind?
Well, it tells me that as a follower of Christ, that people are watching because I'm illuminating.
Okay, good. All right. If you're a disciple of Christ or follower of Christ, other people are watching.
Everybody's watching.
Other people are watching. So are you a leader? To that degree, you are. See, John Maxwell defines leadership as simply influence. And so to some degree, you may not be an elder or deacon or a preacher, but to some degree, you're a leader. You kids, hey kids, let me tell you something. Are you guys homeschool? Or you go to school? Homeschool, okay. But you do things, you're in sports probably or something, you got activities with other kids. Well, you're a leader because you may be the only Christian on your team. You may be the only Christian in that organization or in that activity. And so there you are. Or where you work, you may be the only Christian in that department. Or in the gym, or in that ladies club, or in whatever it is you do. And so other people are watching, and you have an ability to be a leader, to be a disciple of Christ, and to illuminate the way. And to be that salt and be that light. That tells us we're different from the world. There's a fundamental difference, is what he's saying here, between the followers of Christ and people in the world. The world is dark, but we're the light that dispels that darkness. Not only that, there's something here about, in verse 16, about good works. That the light and the salt have to do with good works. And so what about the good works? You have your hand up?
Yeah, well, I mean, when you see opportunity, you need to take advantage of it and be a servant.
All right. So when you see opportunity, take advantage and do good works. Now, is it wrong for other people to know about your good works? Well, it must not be, because he says so here in this text that other people can see it. So it's not wrong, you know, sometimes. Now, we're going to get Matthew 6 next week, and there's a little paradox to this in Matthew 6, and a lot of people camp on that passage, and they forget about this passage. And so if your motive is pure, and you're not doing it to be seen of men, for that purpose, for that motivation, it's not wrong to do things that other people know about. In fact, that if we do everything so secretly that no one knows, then maybe we lack that influence that we could have. I'm encouraged when I know other people are doing good and involved in things. But who does the, according to this passage, I think it's verse 16, who does the glory go to? Me? God, that God might be glorified. And so when you look at the influence, I have an influence that other people can see the works that I'm doing, but that God can receive the glory from all of that. Well, there's other lessons we can learn. Look, I'm going to have to kind of hurry here to get Well, we're in no hurry, are we? Let me just bullet these, though. I mean, we're looking at things here. I mean, you can camp on this. You can think about this the rest of the week and think about the lessons here. Three things, though. There's six points in the rest of this, but I want to look at three of them, verses 21 through 26. And he talks here about what you've heard has been said of old. Now, by the way, all these things that he said you've heard are not necessarily the law of Moses. Some of this is oral law that they've been passed down that they heard. Okay? So don't mistake that. You've heard it, it's been said. What? I thought I heard someone ask something. Okay. You've heard it's been said, you shall not murder. Okay, well that's right. You should murder. But what does he say besides that? Not only what? What is the sin besides murder? Animosity. Hate is the sin. And he uses three words here, anger and reka and fool. The anger, he says, it's anger that expresses itself without a cause. Now, is it a sin to be angry per se? No. God's angry with the wicked every day. God's got a cause. But unjustified and unbridled anger is what he's talking about here. The word reka is an Aramaic word. And it inherent in the word is the idea of contempt and scorn that you have for another person. Okay? And then the word fool is a word that literally means a person that is morally bankrupt or worthless. And so these words are words of disdain that besmirches the character of another person. It's what it's talking about here. So it speaks to a condition of one's heart that has bitterness and ill will and animosity toward a person that spews out this anger in a way that there's no justification for it. Now, how might we be guilty of that? Just a couple thoughts. How might we be guilty of violating what Jesus said there? Well, where? Let me put it this way then. Where might we be guilty of violating it? Well, it begins in the heart. That's exactly right. It begins in the heart. And where in relationships might we be guilty? What? Okay, speaking evil of another, just kind of walking down the street and saying, look at that guy there, he's a moron. We usually don't do that unless we're driving down a road and there are morons that are driving in the middle of the road and stuff. But I'm not talking about that. Where does this usually find itself? Well, in relationships, well, let me help you. How about in a home? Okay, is that where you were going? Well, let me go there and then I'll get you. You know, how many times in the sanctity of our homes might we find ourselves having this kind of anger and ill will and animosity toward a spouse or a parent or a child? You know, sometimes you think, well, in our home you can let your hair down. Some people take their hair off and have never put it back on, okay? I don't know. Well, it's okay to let your hair down, but that didn't give us the right to have a heart that spews out this kind of venom and to speak ugly toward family members. All right, Ruth, where were you going?
I was just going to say that sometimes we hold grudges against people, and people don't know that we are, whether it's a fellow Christian who we feel is wrongness or whether it's somebody at work. We don't voice it out loud, but
right. That's a good illustration because a lot of times it issues itself in a grudge. And we feel that whether it's someone at work or a neighbor or whatever. And we hold that in. And you may not murder them, but you could be guilty here as well. Well, another one, he says, adultery in verses 27 through 30. You've heard you shall not commit adultery. Now, this, the old law The Decalogue does say that. Thou shalt not commit adultery. But Jesus raises for his disciples this to a higher level. And not only should you not commit adultery, but you should not look at a woman to lust after her. For the person that does that has committed adultery in heart. Now, wonder why was Jesus sexist? Why does he put that on a man and speak of a man being guilty of lusting after a woman? I wonder. Any thought about that? What's that? What, Diane?
It's more their nature.
Well, we hate to admit that, Diane, but you're right. I think that's right. Not to say that a woman couldn't lust. A woman could. But I think the makeup of the male is that he is more prone to that than the woman is. More easily prone, let's put it that way. More easily prone. Now, it's interesting when it comes to the issue of modesty, when Paul talks to Timothy about it, who does he put that on, the man or the woman? He puts it on the woman. Now, could a man be immodest? Sure. But is that more prone? I think probably the female is a little bit more prone to that issue. And then he puts it there. And the man is more prone. Now, if you think about that for a second, what might that tell us? Maybe tell you ladies as you think about getting ready to go places. If my premise is right, I think it is. I think just experience and observation tells us it probably is. If we didn't, you don't have to get a degree from University of Missouri in psychology to figure that out. So what might that tell us, ladies? Don't make it more difficult for the man. Don't make it more difficult. And some people, and I know when you talk about this, people get uptight a little bit. Well, don't, you know, I've got the right, don't be telling my wife or daughter, you know, this or that. I'm just saying, you know, you ask some of these guys that pass communion, and some of you guys are already nodding your heads, you know what I'm thinking there. I mean, you see ladies, sisters, that hadn't thought about that. You teach a Bible class. And you see young ladies sometimes that seem not to have thought so much about that issue. And I want to be charitable and think, well, that they're innocent and maybe somewhat naive about this. But mothers and fathers, you need to tell them. Now, try to tell them in a way that you don't run us guys down there. We're a bunch of perverts or something. Okay? But Jesus says, you know, that the man. Now, what makes it difficult in just living in our society to maintain purity and not to lust? What makes it difficult? Besides the way you ladies dress, what?
It's everywhere.
Well, be more precise. Huh?
It's on the, and you have a TV on.
You turn on the TV and there it is. It's on the billboards.
It's in magazines.
It's on the internet.
Yep.
It's at work. It's everywhere. It's everywhere. Now, we can't go out of society. I care. You know, we got to live in society. And so we're going to have to figure out a way to deal with this being everywhere. Exie?
Well, I don't have a computer, but I sometimes go to my daughter's and use her.
Uh-huh.
But whatever you put in that computer, the man,
yeah,
that's what's going to come out.
Yeah.
So if you lusting,
yeah,
and so you know that this is a problem of whomever, whatever the sin may be.
Yeah.
And you know that this is a problem, take it to God and ask God to help you.
Okay.
And he will if you're sincere about it. Now, but you can't say, for instance, it was two brothers. This preacher was saying that. This brother came to him and said, I need some help. See, every time I go to that bus stop, this fine lady is standing there. And this is really bothering me.
Yeah.
And he said, I need help. So the preacher said, well, yeah, let me see if I can help you. Said, you probably need to go catch the bus before she get on, or either wait and catch the bus. So it's always a way out.
Yeah.
It's a way out.
Yeah.
Keep going through the same thing, looking at the same thing.
Yeah.
What you gonna get? You gonna get the same thing.
Hexie, you just covered it. I love it. Everybody listen to Hexie on that? I mean, she just nailed it. We make it difficult. It's simple, isn't it? Don't go to that website. Don't go to that bus stop. Don't go to that restaurant. Yeah. Don't hang around where that is. I mean, you know, Brother Schriegel used to say that he always marveled at lectures when preachers would come down to Florida. And they'd go back up north, and they would write how scandalous the beach was. How scandalous it was the way women dress on the beach. He said, well, what do they think they're going to find out there anyway? And what are you doing out there? You know, if it's that scandalous, what are you doing over there, you see? And so that's, you got it, Exie. I thought I saw a hand. Norma Jean?
You
keep doing the same thing, expect different results. That's the definition of sanity. All right, well, Dick?
When a group of us boys around 15, 16, back in the late 40s, we were sitting in church one day, and one of the kids asked an elder who was sitting with us, what is lust?
Hmm.
He said, well, I'll give you an example of it. You're going through a magazine, and here's a woman.
Ah, yeah. And that's right. The word means to gaze upon. It doesn't mean that you see immodesty. It doesn't, and I've had young people that are dating say, well, you know, we love each other, want to get married, we got feelings for each other. Well, that's not necessarily lust. Hopefully you keep those thoughts pure. And God gave us desires. I mean, that's how the human race continues. But it's when we get an inordinate desire and an improper type where you gaze and in your heart commit that act. See? So, I think, you know, it's like the Supreme Court Justice said, he couldn't define pornography, but he knew it when he saw it. And I think that we know in our heart whether we can give a good definition of love. We know when we've crossed that line and it's become more than just say she's a pretty lady to being lustful. So the guy at the bus stop, he couldn't just see a pretty gal standing there, became a problem. So go to a different bus stop. All right, one more, and then we'll if you want to, we'll sing a little bit. The last section here, verses 38 through 48, Jesus talked about how to love people we don't like. And I call that the spirit of non-retaliation. And he says to turn the other cheek. Turn the other cheek. Someone slaps you, turn the other. Now, you know, when you do that and they come back, you get backhanded. If you slap someone and you turn the other cheek, then you're going to get backhanded, which is the highest form of insult for someone to backhand you. And he says here, don't worry about your rights. In fact, he said, go the extra mile. I think I've talked about this before, either in a class or sermon here, but, you know, the Romans could compel a person to carry their baggage or whatever for a mile under Roman law. And they had markers. So if you were a Jew and a Roman soldier come up and tapped you on the shoulder and said, here, carry my bags, you had to do it. And the Jews hated it. They hated the Romans. They hated the occupation. They hated the idea of being subservient to them. So Jesus didn't say, well, that's not right. You ought to rebel and form some kind of a group and march on the Roman. No. You live in society, be a good citizen, and if that's the law, then, in fact, when the Roman soldier compels you to walk a mile, go with him 2 miles. Now, what do you think that would do to the Roman soldier? That you've walked a mile, and he said, you're miles up, Bill. And you say, you know what, I've really enjoyed walking with you. You mind if I carry your bags another mile? You're different. You're not like other folks. Why would you want to do that? Well, let me tell you about my Jesus. I follow Jesus. You heard of him? When he the one they crucified? Yeah. Yeah, and I'm one of his followers. And our attitude toward the Roman government is that we're subservient. We render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's. And I'm happy to be a servant to you. And you think by the end of that next mile that maybe that soldier's got a different view of Christians, of followers of Christ. And that really just speaks in our social order of the way we conduct ourselves in society, that people see Christ in us, that we go the extra mile in giving and sharing and being what God would have us be. In other words, a gracious giver. Now, you've heard it said, you know, you love them that love you and you hate your enemies. He said, well, what do you more than the Pharisees? They do that. And so Jesus said to love your enemies and bless those who curse you and do good to them and despitefully use you. And verse 48 is where a lot of people take this out of context and misunderstand it. He said, therefore, you shall be perfect just as your Father in heaven is perfect. Now, when you see a therefore, you should ask yourself the question, what? What's it there for? Now, John, when you see a therefore in a context, what's it referred to? Something what? Well, I didn't hear what you said exactly, but I'll let you off the hook in case you gave the wrong answer. When you see a therefore, then it has, huh? It follows what was said before. You come into a conclusion. You've said this, 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 and this, therefore. So he's talked about the attitude and spirit of non-retaliation, the idea of loving even your enemies. Therefore, you should be perfect. Now someone said, well, no one's perfect. Well, the word there doesn't mean sinless, but the word means what?
Complete.
Is God's love complete? Just say yes. It is. He loves everybody, whether they love him or not. By the way, the God of the Muslims doesn't. It says in the Quran, Allah will love you if you love him. That's what the Quran says. Jehovah God's not that God. Jehovah God will love you whether you love him or not. He loves his enemies. Therefore, be complete in your love, is what he's saying. And so if you're a disciple of Christ and you love your brethren and you love your wife and you love your neighbor and you love, you know, all these other people, but if you hate your enemy, your love's incomplete. Your love's incomplete. Now, does anybody think maybe that any of us have got any work to do on discipleship this week? I think I might have a couple things to work on. All right? So think about Matthew 5 and think about these attitudes as you read Luke and John and how that we can be more disciple. All right. Before we go to our house and eat, you want to sing a little bit? Okay. Jerry, you got any songs? Come up and lead us in some songs.
Palaces. Mark, you're back there, turn this mic on. I'll get out of the way. 896, if you want to use your books. My Lord has garments so wondrous fine, and myrrh their texture fills. Its fragrance reached to this heart of mine, with joy my being thrills. Out of the ivory palaces, into a world of woe, only his grace eternal love made my Savior go. His life had also its sorrows sore, for aloes had a part. And when I think of the cross he bore, In garments glorious he will come to open wide the door. And I shall enter my heavenly home to dwell forevermore. Out of the ivory palaces into a world of woe, only his great eternal love made my Savior go. How many of you know Beautiful Star of Bethlehem? Raise your hand if you know it. Uh-oh. Oh, I didn't want to sing a solo. Mark, let's go to the next song. We'll try this another time. This is usually an invitation song for those who feel the need to come forward to heaven's call. What shall it be? 944. What will you do with Jesus? The question comes to you. And you must give an answer, for something you must do. What shall it be? What shall it be? What shall your answer be? What will you do with Jesus? Oh, what will your answer be? What will you do with Jesus? He's knocking at the door. Refuse him, soul, no longer, lest he should plead no more. What shall it be? What shall it be? What shall your answer be? What will you do with Jesus? Oh, what will your answer be? Are there any announcements we need to make right now? We'll do that.
Well, thank you all for being here. If you're visitors and you're not regular attending, we appreciate your presence, and we do ask that you would fill out a visitor's card. And if next few minutes that we have of our service tonight, give that to somebody so we can have a record of your attendance. We do hope you'll do that so we can reach out to you and show you our appreciation. Ken, thank you for your lessons today. We do appreciate it. We appreciate your effort. And Jerry, for your lead and singing tonight. And it's all part of the worship service, and we appreciate your input. Take the Family Matters home. There's plenty to be read in there, plenty to be prayed for, plenty of people who need...